Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into the history and culture of Shay Kerminc.
We've got this incredibly detailed document you sent over, CYAKUArmyNC.pdf.
Exactly. And our job, well, our mission today is to unpack the key insights from it, the real core stuff for everyone listening.
Think of it as digging out the highlights.
Yeah, fast track through what seems like a really long and fascinating story packed into that file.
Absolutely. And it really is a deep dive. This source doesn't just skim the surface. It takes us through
From
centuries.
ancient settlements right up to more modern figures, yeah.
Exactly. So we'll pull out the most, well, compelling bits, give you a solid grasp without being totally bogged down in every single detail.
Okay, so let's kick off with something that honestly it jumped out at me right from the start.
Oh, yeah. What was that?
Well, the book opens with this personal story from 1982. The author talks about a chat with some Arab colleagues, and one of them basically questioned how long Kurds had actually lived in the Afrin region, suggested they were, pretty recent arrivals.
Right, that whole narrative.
Yeah, maybe even pushed out earlier Arab folks. But here's the kicker. The author asked him, just name one Arab who was displaced by Kurds there. And the colleague couldn't name a single one. So that very question, the origins, the historical roots, that seems to be a central thread here.
It really does. That anecdote perfectly sets the stage, doesn't it? It highlights this core question that the rest of the document seems dedicated to exploring.
So it aims to show the depth of that Kurdish presence.
Precisely. It unpacks a lot of information to trace that history in Shay Kerminc going way, way back.
So where does it start? Which scholars does it lean on for those early origins?
Well, it mentions people like Fledimir Menariski, Sedney Smez, and Emi Zeki.
And their thinking is.
They generally suggest that the ancient mountain peoples of the Near East were, well, the ancestors of the Kurds.
Implying a long-standing presence in those highland areas, not newcomers.
Exactly. That's the key takeaway. It argues against the idea of them being recent arrivals to mountainous regions.
And Emin Zeki, he offers a more specific connection, doesn't he?
He does. Zeki proposes a link to the Akkadian dynasty.
Acadians. Wow, okay.
Yeah, suggesting a migration from the Arabian Peninsula, around the 23rd century BCE.
That's quite a claim.
It is. And interestingly, the source kind of parallels this with Turkish claims of descent from the QAnon people in China way back when.
Ah, so it's highlighting how groups construct these deep origin stories.
Sort of, yeah. How different peoples look back to ancient lineages to, anchor their historical presence and legitimacy in a place.
It always comes back to that connection to the land, I suppose. So, beyond the theories, what about actual physical evidence, early settlements, links to Mesopotamia?
The source definitely points to archaeology. It talks about evidence of early settlements and really strong ties to Mesopotamia.
Okay.
Mentions older sites being destroyed, new ones popping up, including a really important one called Alalax.
Alex, Jire et Sana today.
That's the one. It has real historical weight.
So what did they find there? What's the connection?
The archaeologist El Wali did significant work there. He uncovered Mesopotamian-style pottery.
And this dates back how far?
Late 4th, early 3rd millennia BCE. We're talking, thousands of years old.
Wow.
And the style is similar to what you find in Mesopotamia proper. So it's not just like random pots. It indicates real interaction.
Trade, cultural exchange, maybe even people moving between the Imok Plain and Mesopotamia.
Could be all of the above. It suggests strong links, yeah. Collateral, possibly ethnic.
So these connections are ancient, but Alex changed over time, right? Different people came in.
It did. Around the last third of the 3rd millennium BCE, new groups arrived, seemingly from the north and east.
And before that, was it independent?
It seems like it was independent for a good chunk of the 3rd millennium BCE, but then it fell under Akkadian rule around 2300 BCE.
So a distinct place, but also caught up in the bigger regional powers?
Exactly. Part of that whole ancient Near Eastern complex.
Okay, so we've got these early layers. Moving forward, the book talks a lot about the Hurrians and Hittites, big players. Why are they so significant for this story?
The Hurrians are presented as really key. They're described as a major mountain people, Zagros and Taurus Mountains again.
And they formed an empire.
A big one, yeah. The Mitanni Empire, mid-second millennium BCE, controlled a huge area in the northern Near East.
And the crucial link.
The source stresses they're widely acknowledged as ancient ancestors of the Kurdish people.
So not just the mountain people, but the ancestors, according to this view.
That's the argument presented. Yes.
Yeah.
A direct lineage, widely supported by historians and linguists, apparently.
Okay, and then the Hittites enter the picture. How do they fit in?
They arrive around 1650 BCE. Interestingly, their first attempts to expand eastward were apparently blocked by the Hurrians.
Really? So the Hurrians pushed back?
Seems so. Which redirected the Hittites west, towards the Taurus, and eventually they set up their own powerful state near the Halys River.
But they didn't just stay there. They clashed with the Mitanni eventually.
Oh yeah. From about 1430 BCE, the Hittites started putting serious pressure on the Mitanni kingdom. Lots of conflict.
So these two powers were constantly interacting, sometimes clashing, maybe influencing each other.
Absolutely. The Hittites eventually pushed into the Amuk Plain, taking key cities like Aleppo and Alax.
Despite Hurrian resistance.
Despite strong Mitanni-Hurrian resistance, yeah. By the late 14th century BCE, the Hittites had basically defeated the Mitanni-Hurrian power in northern Syria, a major shift.
The book mentions something fascinating, archaeological hints of continued resistance in Alax, even after a Hittite king died.
Yes, Upaluliuma I. He died in 1347 BCE. After that, there seems to have been unrest, maybe revolts in Aleppo and Alax against Hittite rule. They were put down, but what's really interesting is the pottery. Mutsi pottery continued to be widely used in Alax during this time.
Mutsi pottery?
Yeah, and Dr. Hisham Sefidi, according to the source, suggests this might have been a kind of silent protest.
Using pottery as protest, how so?
Like sticking to their own cultural styles, their own traditions, as a subtle way to resist Hittite domination, maintaining identity.
That's actually quite powerful, just
right.
Everyday objects carrying that weight. The source also touches on how these groups shaped later populations, like the Assyrians.
Right. Dr. Sefidi observes that the Hurrians influenced the Assyrians, kind of differentiating them a bit from their Semitic relatives further south.
So, cultural mixing again.
Definitely. And Morkart confirms this idea of assimilation in various groups, including early civilizations like Til Helf and Samara founders, plus Hurrians and Suvarians, all fed into the Assyrian population.
It just shows how complex the ethnic history of the ancient Near East really was. Interwoven.
Totally.
Okay, amazing how these ancient links still echo. Jumping ahead again, the book mentions the land of the Gudi in Assyrian texts. Who were they? Relevant to Shaye Kermink.
Guti seems to have been a pretty broad term the Assyrians used for peoples north and northeast of them.
Like who?
Medes, Mitanni, Urartu, Scythians, Sumerians, basically a lot of the mountain populations of the time.
And the connection.
Well, King Tiglath-Pileser's records from 638 BCE mention deporting some of these Gudi peoples to northern Syria and Phoenicia.
Ah, so showing movement and interaction between those mountain regions and Syria, potentially including areas that later became Kurdish.
Exactly. It establishes that historical link, that movement of people.
Then, much later, the Romans arrive. Big impact, obviously. How did they affect Chiayi Kermink specifically?
Romans rolled in around 64 CE. Syria becomes a Roman province, Antioch the capital.
Right.
And the source highlights Chiayi Kermink and the Semen region as being strategically important. Wealthy, probably from agriculture, trade routes.
Which means?
Conflict. Constant struggles with the Parthians to the east, who also wanted control of this valuable area.
Okay, fast forward a few centuries again. The Arab conquest. How did that reshape the region?
7th century CE. That's the big shift. Habib bin Maslama al-Fari leads the conquest.
Take Cyrus. Cyros.
Yeah, Cyros. And by 637 CE, the whole region is under Arab control. But interestingly, the source notes the Juma Plain already existed then, with inhabited villages.
Suggesting some continuity in settlement, even with the change in rulers.
Seems like it, yeah.
And didn't the region become its own administrative unit at one point?
Under Caliph Harun al-Rashid, yes. The area, Minbik, Diloc, Cyros, Entek, Tizen, all that became an independent unit called Owasim.
With Manbi as the center.
Manbi as the center.
Right.
So it had its own administrative importance within the caliphate for a time.
And the local Kurds, were they involved in the politics then? Particularly with the Hamdanids?
The source says yes. The Hamdanids, this Arab dynasty in the 10th century, apparently relied on Kurdish support.
How so?
Nasir al-Dawla al-Hamdani even allied with them, married a Kurdish woman named Fatme. And the Kurds provided crucial military muscle for him and his son.
So integrated into the political and military scene by that point.
It certainly looks that way. Growing influence.
Right. So we're seeing this Kurdish presence woven through these later periods. But the book really digs into this debate. When did significant Kurdish settlement happen in Afrin? Because there are different ideas, right?
Yeah, this is crucial. And it loops back to that opening story. Some claims suggest it was mainly a 20th century thing, displacement from Turkey.
But the prevailing view in the source
is much earlier. Modern researchers, according to this text, place significant settlement in the Middle Ages, you know, 476 to 1453 CE, and continuing through the Crusader and Ayyubid periods.
So centuries earlier than the 20th century idea.
Definitely. Some hints, maybe even earlier, but the Middle Ages is the main time frame cited. The key point is, it's not presented as a recent phenomenon.
Does the book offer specific accounts to back this up?
It does. It mentions Baba Bulis Yetim, who wrote about Kurds arriving in the Afrin Valley during the Middle Ages, noting Syriacs were already there.
Showing interaction with existing populations.
Exactly. And then Samuel Kinney, his view is even stronger. He asserts a continuous Kurdish presence right back to the Hurrians. He sees it as an ancestral homeland.
Wow, continuous. That's a big claim.
It is. The source also mentions likely Kurdish Zoroastrians in Gundar in the 12th century and Yazidi Kurds arriving from Mesopotamia in the 13th. It builds a picture of a long, evolving presence.
And is there physical evidence, too? Old buildings, graves?
Yes, definitely. Tangible stuff, like a house in Bourbonnais with 1173 AH carved on it. That's late 18th century.
Okay.
Graves in Serray from 1223 AH, so early 1800s. And Bilile Shorbe's grave in Shorb, suggesting a 250-year presence when the research was done.
So these things on the ground contradict a purely 20th century arrival story.
Strongly suggest a deeper history, yeah. Plus, it mentions Druze communities in places like Kafrian and Benabil from the time of the Emirate of Keles, so a mixed, long-established population.
And this presence wasn't just limited to Chiye Kermanc itself, Kurds elsewhere in Syria.
That's right. The book notes Kurds in Weir, between Hama and Homs, and also the Ekrad Dazni Kurds near Homs, shows a wider distribution historically.
Okay, let's shift focus to the Emirate of Keles.
Huh.
This sounds like a period of significant Kurdish political power in the area. How did that emerge?
Right. So by the late Ayyubid period, the southern part of Siyaye Kermanc and the Juma area fell under a Kurdish emir, Mir Mend. His base was the Qasir fortress.
Okay.
But then, as the Ayyubids faded in the early 14th century, the Mend emir shifted their power base north to Keles.
Keles, near Syros.
About 15 kilometers east of Syros, yeah. Their territory grew to include Juma and Siyaye Kermanc. And importantly, the source says they kept a level of independence from the Mamluks.
So Keles becomes this Kurdish power center. What happens when the Ottomans take over the wider region?
Keles continues as the hub of a semi-autonomous emirate of Keles, even under the Ottomans, starting from the 16th century.
Still run by the same family line.
By the Mendi family and their descendants, the Kampalatis, yeah. Covering Siyaye Kermanc, Jume, Azaz. The Kampalat Mosque, built in Keles in 1554, is like solid proof of their influence then.
There's a story in the book about the Kampalats and the Sultan, isn't there? Sounds a bit dramatic.
Very dramatic. A Kampalat figure was apparently removed from the Sultan's court, put in the honor guard, but he did well militarily, got back in favor.
Okay.
The Sultan even thought about giving him back his ancestral emirate, but then maybe worried about stirring up Kurdish power.
He backed off.
He offered him a sanjak in Aleppo instead. You know, an administrative district, but not the full emirate. And Kampalat refused it.
Refused the Sultan. Bold move. What happened next?
Well, the refusal clearly worried the Sultan. Sultan Murad IV sent this guy, Hussein Zaneh Gadim, to check out the situation with the Kurds in the Keles province.
Suggests they were watching that region closely, concerned about autonomy.
Very closely, yeah.
And this tension eventually led to rebellion, the Kampalatis against the Ottomans.
It did. In 1607, there was a Kampalati rebellion in Aleppo. It failed, though. Ali Beg Kampalati, the last Mendi emir, was killed.
So the end of that semi-autonomous emirate.
Pretty much. After that, the Ottomans started appointing governors for Keles directly from Istanbul, trying to tighten control.
But they appointed a Kurd at one point from the Berwari tribe.
Yeah, interestingly, a guy from the Robari branch claiming this long lineage back to a Mehmed Pasha Robari from Sirte shows the complexity still involving Kurdish figures.
And even with direct Ottoman governors, did local Kurdish power just disappear? Or did they find ways to resist?
There was still resistance. The book mentions Ismail Aga Erbali and Abdin Aga challenging the governor in the early 18th century under Ashikli Ali Aga.
Were they successful?
They were eventually suppressed, but the Robari tribe themselves managed to hang on to a degree of semi-independence in Basut Castle. So local power structures persisted.
And then another Kurdish group arrives, the Genji. from Konya.
Right. Around 1737, they came into Shia Kermenk, clashed with the Robari in the Jumet Plain.
And who came out on top?
The Genji eventually took control of Basut Castle, so a shift in the local balance of power between different Kurdish factions.
This leads into the 18th century, which the book describes as the era of the Derebeys. Feudal lords, basically.
Yeah, that's a key term for this period. Derbeylik local feudal lordship. The central Ottoman power was maybe weaker, allowing these local lords to rise.
Any prominent examples?
Hek Omer from the Reshwan tribe is highlighted. He got the Derbeylik of Siyayek Kurdan, the Kurdish mountains, in 1742, and his family held onto power for generations.
And the book tells quite a story about his grandson, Selah Aga. Sounds like he really challenged the Ottomans.
Oh, absolutely. Selah Aga became super influential in Kilis, built up a lot of power, openly defied the state.
How'd that end?
The Ottomans eventually sent forces in 1854. He resisted for a while but had to surrender. And his residence in Kilis, it became the old barracks. Now it's a state hospital.
Yeah, a physical reminder of that local power.
Exactly.
This is also a time of wider unrest. The book mentions an Armenian revolt in the Kilis area.
Yes, in 1895, an Armenian uprising against the Ottoman state in Kilis, Antep, that whole area. Unfortunately, the source says it was forcefully put down, a period of real turmoil.
Okay, let's move into the 20th century. World War I ends, the Ottoman Empire collapses, the French mandate begins in Syria. How did the French view Shia Kermenk?
Well, after the Ottomans withdrew in 1918, the British and then the French took control. The French mandate gave France administrative power over Syria.
And Shia Kermenk within that.
Significantly, the source says the French actually recognized its distinct national character when setting up the administrative boundaries within the Aleppo Sanjak.
They defined it as a specific Kurdish area.
It seems so. It was defined with 10 districts, acknowledging its particular makeup.
Do we know who the French put in charge locally, initially?
Yeah, the book names a few. In the Bilbil district, first Ebdeleni Uzal, then Manan Aga Ismail Zed in 1923, and later that year, Semil Kine.
Semil Kine again, the writer and intellectual.
The same one. Shows the French were engaging with existing local figures, presumably.
And this period saw the beginnings of Afrin Town itself developing more formally.
It seems so. The first official building, the Sera, was set up then. A sign of formal administration.
And a civil registry.
Yes, in 1932. The first official was Rishite Eli Kuwe. So the structures of a modern town were starting to appear, although the source notes Afrin's bigger growth spurt wasn't until the late 1960s.
Right. Okay, let's shift gears a bit from politics and administration to the social and cultural side. The book talks about traditional clothing.
It does, and it draws parallels between the traditional Kurdish clothes in Siyayek Kermenk and the attire of ancient peoples like the Lolo, Mitanni, Hurrians, Kassites, Medes.
Based on whose research?
It references the Soviet scholar Dieganov, mentions specific things like the Kwelek hat, the Surme shawl, suggests a really long continuity in dress style.
Fascinating. Another cultural point was about names changing, personal names.
Yeah, apparently from the second half of the 20th century onwards, there was a trend towards using names with more national, social, or nature-based meanings.
Moving away from older naming conventions.
Seems like it. The book gives lots of examples for girls and boys, and a survey in Afrin in 2000 apparently showed a big jump in Kurdish names compared to the 70s.
Reflecting a stronger assertion of identity, maybe?
That's likely the implication, yeah. A conscious choice in naming.
What about traditions around big life events? Weddings? Births?
Some really specific wedding customs are described. Like a race for young men to deliver the bride's mirror to the groom's village winner gets a prize.
Sounds lively.
Mm-hmm. And putting a young boy behind the bride on her horse for good luck, hoping for sons. Also, the bride wouldn't get off the horse until the groom's father promised gifts, livestock, land, whatever.
A bit of negotiation there.
Hey.
And birth customs.
Rituals around the placenta and umbilical cord, burying it somewhat clean, or tossing the cord onto the roof of a respected person's house, hoping the child takes after them.
Interesting symbolism.
And babies were swaddled in decorated white cloths, often with images of flowers, birds, especially peacocks.
Gives you a real feel for daily life. What about food? Traditional cuisine.
It sounds like it was based on local, simple ingredients. Things like sushav, which is like a fruit compote. Dried figs were important.
Makes sense for the region.
Lots of milk products, fruits, and foraging for wild greens. Things like kardi, a type of artichoke, and various stuffed vegetables, using whatever was in season.
And traditional ways of dealing with health. before modern medicine became widespread.
Honey comes up as a key remedy, used for lots of things. The source also mentions specific traditional views on illnesses like Warane, a wasting disease, and trachoma, the eye infection.
But healthcare improved significantly later on.
Oh, yes. The book clearly states that by the early 21st century, there was a big increase in doctors, pharmacies, modern facilities in the Afrin region, a clear shift.
Okay, just jumping back quickly to the administration under the Ottomans. The book detailed the setup in Kilis.
Yeah, it laid out the structure. You had the Kuymakam, district governor, administrative councils, municipal councils, a court, a WAC committee for endowments, education branch, agricultural council.
A fairly standard Ottoman setup for a provincial town.
Looks like it. Plus a military reserve. It also mentions early telegraph lines coming in the late 19th century. Signs of modernization creeping in.
The book also throws in a story about a bandit. Ceylon. Adds a bit of local color.
Yes. Ceylon from Sekla village, described as really daring, elusive. The police even used helicopters to try and catch him, apparently.
How did his story end?
He was killed in 1973, reportedly by an acquaintance, maybe with state involvement. End of an era, perhaps.
Right. Finally, the book makes a point of highlighting notable figures from C.A. Kermenk. Important individuals.
Yes. It profiles several people who really left their mark.
Like who?
Hek Rishet Seksmail, known as Kor Rishet, seems he was hugely respected for his wisdom. Simil Kine, or Simil Berry, the writer we mentioned, but also had a naval background. Osman Mehmet Osman, a judge, spoke multiple languages, active in Kurdish affairs.
A real mix of roles.
Definitely. Evde Shiri, a famous folk poet and singer. Hunerman Adik, a musician known for the tembur and Comanche. And Semil Horo, the singer famous for Aisha Ibe and other traditional songs.
It's good to remember these names, the people behind the history. The book also talks about political activity in the mid-20th century. Elections. Kurdish parties.
It does. It mentions people from CIA Kurmek running in Syrian parliamentary elections. Names like Rishi Temo, Emet Sifir Shesmail, Fake Manan Aksa Shesmail Zaid.
Trying to get representation within the Syrian system.
Exactly. It also notes the emergence of the Kurdish Democratic Party in Syria, and later the Ba'ath Party's growing influence. Shows the Kurds engaging with that evolving political scene.
There were also a couple of really intense personal stories included, weren't there? Giving a glimpse into earlier times.
Yeah, quite dramatic ones. There's Suleiman's story.
What happened with him?
He apparently killed a dervish in a dispute, felt terrible regret, went to Egypt to study religion.
Okay.
Came back, and then, believing it would atone for his sin, he tried to assassinate the French army leader in Damascus in 1891.
Wow. Did he succeed?
No, he was caught and executed. A really tragic, intense story.
And the other one, Ituno.
Ituno was a bandit, but respected in the Aleppo area. Known for being chivalrous towards women, apparently.
An honorable outlaw type.
Kind of, yeah. But still an outlaw. The Ottomans eventually caught and executed him, too. These stories give you a real flavor of the times.
And finally, resistance against the French mandate itself.
Yeah.
Led by local figures.
Yes. The book specifically mentions Seydike and Hekinan as leading resistance efforts in CIA Kermenk against the French.
Connecting local actions to the broader independence movement.
Exactly. Part of that whole regional struggle during that era.
So wrapping this all up, this deep dive into CIA KURMENC.PDF has painted a picture of a really long, complex, and rich history.
Absolutely. You go from these incredibly ancient civilizations through the rise and fall of empires, the Hittites, Romans, Ottomans, to the clear emergence and persistence of these Kurdish communities, their culture, their politics, their connection to this specific place.
It's a story of resilience, isn't it?
Yeah.
And cultural continuity alongside all the changes.
Very much so. A deep, deep connection to the land running through it all.
And it really throws that initial question into sharp relief, doesn't it?
Mm.
The one about Kurds being recent arrivals.
Completely. This exploration shows roots stretching back millennia, not just decades. It fundamentally challenges that narrative and reveals just how layered the history is.
Which kind of leads to a final thought maybe for our listeners to ponder.
Go on.
Well, considering this long, complex history we've touched on, how do these historical narratives, these deep roots, get interpreted or maybe even contested today?
That's a big question. How history is used in the present.
Yeah. What role does knowing this deep history, the Hurrians, the Emirates, the resistance, play in how people understand identity, belonging, and, well, current events in regions like this?
Definitely something to think about. the weight of the past on the present.
And look, we've really only skimmed the highlights here. That source, sayayekormiannc.pdf, has so much more detail.
Oh, absolutely. More on social life, religion, folklore, loads of other figures.
So if this has piqued your interest, we definitely encourage you to dive into the document itself. There's a lot more to uncover about this remarkable region.